Have you ever felt like you were meant for something more? Today's guest was born in a small town in Georgia, got pregnant before she was married during the 1960s, and went on to become the president of CNN Features and is now the curator of TED Women. She is also the author of Becoming a Dangerous Woman, Embracing Risk to Change the World.
Welcome to Podcast Coaching with Christine. I'm your host, Christine O'Donnell. I'm an Emmy-nominated TV journalist and podcast coach. Each week, I interview someone who has an exceptional story and talent to help independent podcasters grow their shows.
Hello, and welcome to the show. If you are a podcaster who wants to learn about how to be a game changer in your industry, if you'd like to learn the importance of financial literacy and how to share your story on the TED stage, this is the episode for you. Also, I don't think I know one podcaster who is not also embracing risks, which is why I think that Pat Mitchell's episode is just so powerful. Her story is powerful, and her life's mission, you guys, has been to be an advocate for women and girls. This is very important to me and dear to my heart. And if you have been watching the news, if the news keeps you up at night too, then you know that there is a very scary and uncertain future for many Afghan women and girls right now. So I would like to bring special attention to her episode, also to my episode with Arzo Youssef, who is an Afghan woman. So I'm going to link that in the show notes as well. Right now, Pat Mitchell, who is the star of this podcast, she is doing her best to raise awareness about what is happening in Afghanistan and to raise funds. And so I'm going to send you guys to this website. If you want to learn more, go to protectafghanwomen.org. And there's a bunch of information there. And I suggest you take a few minutes just to read it and learn how you can impact and make some small, hopeful change in a positive change in these women's lives. Many, you know, women or young women who have never known what it is like to be oppressed, or who may have gone to school and gone to college and now all of a sudden are not allowed to work, or may not be allowed to work. I think that there's still some stuff being figured out, and I'm hoping for the best. I can't help it. So that's what I'm going to do. So to move on a little bit, I wanted to say again, hello and welcome. I myself have been in a period of transition. My family and I just moved from Los Angeles to New York, and we are still looking for a house. We're currently staying with my dad. I'm doing this recording from my dad's basement. I have a little setup here. I'm going to take a picture so y'all can see it. But that is the beauty of podcasting, right? You can do it anywhere. And I also wanted to take a moment to just shout out all of my Brightsiders. You guys, these past few weeks have been, again, a huge period of transition for me, but I know it's also been that way for you. And it has been such an honor for me to work with you, to see your shows develop, to see your shows grow, to see you not only impact your listeners with your message, but also to impact each other's podcasts and lives. So I wanted to let you know how much you inspire me, how much I am moved by the stories that you're sharing, and to keep on keeping on. You know, there's ups and downs in all of our lives, and I'm here. and you're here, and we're moving forward together. So if you are someone who is curious what the heck I'm talking about, I'll put a link in the show notes that shares more information about my community of Brightsiders. And so there will be some information there. But now let's move on. Let's move back to Pat Mitchell. And I'm going to share a little bit more about her. So if you missed that last episode I did with her, I'm going to be sharing some of my favorite moments from that interview with her. And Pat Mitchell is a pioneer for women in media. She is a glass ceiling breaker and someone who has bravely used her voice to make an impact for women and girls time and time again. She's an Emmy Award winner, an Oscar nominee, a journalist, a war correspondent, and the former president of CNN Productions. She is currently the editorial director of TED Women and the chair of the Sundance Institute, not to mention an author. So she has done so many amazing things, and her story is just so wonderful. So if you ever felt like you had the cards stacked against you in the deck, this is the episode for you. Please enjoy. And without further ado, here's my interview with Pat.
Pat Mitchell, thank you so much for being on my show. How are you?
I'm good.
I have read your book. It's amazing. And something that, you know, one of your chapters really struck, I mean, gosh, so many did, you open with falling forward and you talk about, you know, some of the things that you went through growing up and, you know, with your pregnancy early on, and then balancing becoming a mom with your ambition and trying to do the best both places while also like feeding that like need inside of yourself to do something purposeful. What would you say to women today who are trying to balance all of those things as well?
I think balance is one of those concepts that just we're never going to get it absolutely right. And so we're always struggling to get it right. But I don't know that balance is possible. And I've come to believe now that I don't even want it. I mean, I like being, as my family likes to describe, over-engaged, overactive. I much prefer that to being sitting on the sidelines somewhere, right? So when I, you know, unexpectedly found myself becoming a mother at age 22, I didn't have any concept of what that would mean to the pursuit of my own life at 22. What do you know about what you want and need? I realize now my son and I grew up together. We really did. And I didn't do a lot of things right. And I certainly did not have balance. We didn't have nannies. You know, we just ran home to try and do everything all at one time. And that is the trap we all get caught in, is trying to do everything, be everything, all at the same time. Because we're not given the option, as women often, and it is an option men have more often, and that is to stage their lives. You know, they can focus on the work at one time in the day or their lives. Women are trying to focus on everything all at one time because we have those varied responsibilities. What I had wished I had, and I wish now for you and all the other young women listening, is to be kinder to myself. I wish I had just realized that this balance I was going for, feeling like I was a good mother and I was pursuing my work with my full capacity and capabilities, that I had been kinder about realizing what I was juggling and what I was doing right. Because it's a guilt that you feel you're never in the right place at the right time. And that is not healthy for anyone. It doesn't improve the lives of our children. It certainly doesn't improve our lives. I did have this wonderfully wise woman who had 5 children and who was also the first woman editor of a major newspaper in this country. And she took the job at 60 And I remember saying to her, it's kind of laughable now that I'm 78 that I thought she was old. But I remember saying to her, wow, taking this kind of big job at this age and at five children. And she, you know, she said to me that wonderful thing, women need to think of our bodies and our lives as seasons. We have seasons. Men have sort of one season primarily, and that's not being entirely fair to men, but women do have real seasons, seasons of giving birth and then not, and menopause and all the other things that we go through, to see them all as just places on the journey. And no, we can't be in all those places on the journey all at one time. And that would have put my ambitions or aspirations or dreams into a different context. And it would have allowed me to be, I think, more joyful about being a mother as well.
Gosh. So such a great point, because there is this guilt factor that I think that, I mean, I personally try to overcome it. The other day I was talking about ambition, literally last night, actually, I was talking about the word ambition, like it was a bad thing for a woman to be, because I'm ambitious. And a lot of the women that I surround myself by are super ambitious. And I was like, why do I have this stuck in my head that this is a bad thing? Like, why does that make me evil? Like the bad guy in a show. And I was like, am I Cruella? Like what's going on? Right. Like, it's almost a socialization that I have to untrain myself, because I don't believe it. But then I find myself falling back into that trap where I like, oh, don't use that A word.
Well, there are a lot of those words that dog us all the way through our lives, because they're words that we didn't put all those connotations around it, but society and culture has. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, different in different cultures and places, but we have to own those words and own those concepts in a different way. And it's definitely not easy. And you can't just wake up one morning and say, I'm going to be okay about being ambitious. I'm going to be okay about not being home at 5 o'clock or not preparing the best dinner or not all the knots in the nose. Because we have the power, again, using that word, to change all of the ways in which we have been socialized and culture has taught us to compete with each other, to compare ourselves to each other, to always feel that we haven't quite measured up. There's so many sociological studies that prove how this has held us back from achieving our own dreams and full potential. So it is something, though, that we need to be aware of, just as Black and brown communities have to be aware constantly of the stereotypes and the culturalizations that are put on top of their lives, the narrative that they have to push back and struggle against all the time. So do women of all colors, shapes, sizes, and everywhere in the world, because there isn't anywhere in the world, Christine, where we are truly equal. Nowhere. There are countries where we are closer to it, a lot closer. The U.S. is not one of them, by the way. We're like 52 on that gender index, so that means a lot of countries are far better places to be a woman than the U.S. But even with all the progress we've made here and other places, we're still not fully equal in the eyes of the law, which matters, in the eyes of constitutions, which matter, and in the eyes of the cultural narrative that has been created around us and about us, but not often enough by us. So that is where that's the lever for change. And that's where we have to focus our energies, our positive thoughts on changing this, changing the narrative, because we have the power to do that.
You know, I agree with you. And I think it's about getting out of our own heads. And that's such a push we don't like change. Nobody does. I don't. I mean, I do, because I try to remind myself it's the only thing that I can count on is change. Mm-hmm. So I really should just enjoy it. But then we get comfortable and then we forget that we're supposed to enjoy, at least
I'm projecting here, but we forget that we're supposed to enjoy change. Speaking of, I Googled top countries to be a woman. And I was thinking in the back of my head, oh, those Vikings, they knew what was mm-hmm. up. Those women were fierce. And that's it. Those are the top countries right there.
But
Sweden,
it's important.
Denmark.
Yeah. And the Nordic countries and a few other island countries. But it's also important to remember that in indigenous communities all over the world, that was not the narrative about women. Women were not only fully equal, they were in charge.
Yeah.
And in indigenous cultures today, all over the world, in Costa Rica, in many of the island countries, in this country, there are still indigenous communities where they're matriarchal. Mm-hmm. And I love the ones that in the Northeast United States, those tribes, the women not only ran everything, the women were the only ones who could vote. They elected the chiefs. I mean, the men were chiefs, but they were elected by the women. And what, you know, I'm not, by the way, this sounds like I'm, you know, playing into that game of if women win, men lose. Not true. Yeah. That is the game that has kept us on the sidelines way too long. But this is, for me, just a recognition that we're different, that we bring different skills, attributes, qualities, even values, and certainly we bring different lived experiences to every decision-making table. So some societies chose to put women at those decision-making tables because they valued the certain attributes that women brought to decision-making. So I just like to see more of that around the world, not at the expense of men not being there too, but just for the purpose of fully realizing all of the capacity of women and all of the capacity of men to work together toward problem solving.
Absolutely. And I want to, because you have kind of touched on this theme here, that you reminded me of, you know, your show, Woman to Woman. So this, I mean, you were working with women to produce a show for women that had never been done before. And this was before Oprah. This is the Oprah before Oprah show. Like, Pat, like, it's an amazing story, what you had done there. And anyone listening, please, please, Becoming a Dangerous Woman, it is an amazing book. And one of the things that you talk about that I think is so valuable is that power struggle. Like, once people wanted to come in and kind of take this amazing thing away, and it was like, do we fund it? How do we fund it? What do we do? And I think something you mentioned is like, I would have done it differently had I known more. And yeah. I felt like it was such, like, I was so like lucky to read this book because now I have like your lived experience in my mind. Like, thank goodness every woman who's in media should read this book to understand like the power dynamics and what it takes to pitch yourself to people and to get funding for these projects and to work with other women in the way that you did. I mean, do you want to talk about that experience? And I also think podcasters could totally learn from that as well.
Well, yeah, I really appreciate your bringing that particular story forward. And by the way, it's worth mentioning that this is the way women learn and the way we connect and the way that we move forward is by, it's by sharing our stories. Because in our stories, we see all the commonalities of the struggles and of the challenges. So I shared that story, among others, in the book because I think it's apocryphal. Here we were, my partner and myself, another woman who I worked with. We had a big idea. Let's produce a television show for women that is produced by women, by the way, and hosted by a woman, in this case, me. And everybody went, that's crazy. So we would go to try and sell the show to a male general manager of a television network. And he would say, no, nobody will watch a show. Women don't want that kind of television. And I'd say, take it home to your wife. Let her take a look at it. Are you a girlfriend? Are you just any woman in your life? Just show it to her. And every time they did that, he would come back and go, you know, you're right. They loved it. They saw themselves there. They said, wow, that's me. That's my story. So the show not only went on the air, it won the Emmy as the best daytime television show. We had a huge audience of women grateful that there was an hour every day where they could actually hear other women telling their stories and sharing their life experiences, their challenges, as well as their accomplishments. Oprah Winfrey at the time was a local television show in Chicago. We were the national show, and she would be the lead in to our show. So that's how we got to know each other, as she was promoting my show and I was promoting her in Chicago. But the thing we didn't do right, we did everything else right. We got it on the air. We sold the show. We had a staff of 80 women, half of whom had babies. We had on-site daycare because I wanted them to be with their children and not be separated. We had everything going, except we didn't figure out the financial possibilities. And the financial part of our lives was managed by a group of men who did understand what the opportunity was. So they sold the show. They sold the company out from under us. And we had less than a month to try and refinance and keep the program on the air. And neither Mary nor myself knew enough about what our deal was, knew enough about what our opportunities were, what our choices and options were. And therefore, we made a quick and easy decision, easy meaning it could happen right away, to sell the show back to NBC Network, where we had both worked before. But in doing so, we gave up all the rights to everything. So for people who are starting out in business, women entrepreneurs in particular, so much, you're all so much better informed, and I'm so much better informed now. But it's you have to know every part of your business. Every part. You can't delegate something to someone else. It's really important to feel informed and to feel in charge. So there's much more I could say about that, but the lesson for me there was, the next time you set up your own company, you're going to do it with financing that you arrange, me, and you'll be much more in control of the future of what happens to it. That story didn't turn out badly because Oprah then took our time slots that we had and became the Oprah Winfrey Show nationally and made television history, which, so that's a good thing. And then I went on to have a really interesting career as an executive too. So I'm not reliving the past because I regret anything. I'm reliving the story because there are lessons there for other people who are starting out in their own businesses.
Absolutely. And I feel like, and something that I just connect to so much here is because, like, I identify as a journalist, I identify as a storyteller, I want to support other women. And so as I was reading about this, and then like this heavy, like, idea of understanding the financial background of my business and like getting funding for different projects, like, it's such an uncomfortable place for me to go because I don't understand it. And part of me just doesn't want to understand it. And I think that that's not fair to me. I'm not giving myself enough credit where I can absolutely understand it. I just, well, have been putting it off.
Yeah. Well, look, here's the point, Christine. We can't be experts in everything. Yes, I will never be a financial expert. I will never play the market. It's just not of interest enough to me, frankly. But give yourself, you know, some room. So find the right people that you trust. It's part of surrounding ourselves with people that we trust. I do think that finance is sort of the last frontier of feminism. You know, we really do have to kind of conquer that complete understanding or enough understanding to be in as much control of that part of our lives as we are in all. And we know women aren't, because they're so still facing the challenge of financial inequity everywhere in almost every situation. But I'll just tell you a funny other story. I got invited to be on the Bank of America board, my first corporate board, the Bank of America, the largest bank in this country, maybe the world at that point. And I said to the CEO who wanted me to be on the board because I was the president of PBS, and he wanted a media person and a media person beyond reproach, you know, PBS. And I said, I don't know the first thing about banking. And I even told him my story about Woman to Woman. And he said, well, I'll get you a financial tutor. And he did. So for the whole time I was on the Bank of America board, I had a financial tutor who sat with me every week or so and would go through all the materials that I needed to understand. Now, he didn't teach me how to be a banker. That wasn't the point. He taught me how to know enough to make the right decisions as a board member. So there are ways, you know, for us to conquer these fears that don't have to do with making ourselves feel badly because we don't get it all totally. There's that other great thing about women is when we apply for a job, we think we have to tick every single box. Oh, well, I only have 3 years experience, not five, so I better not apply. Do you know that men never, ever think about that? According to all the studies that have been done among job recruiting organizations, men don't look at the boxes because they assume whatever the boxes indicate, they can learn it. Mm-hmm. They can do it. So the thing I encourage us all as women to do more of is to learn by doing. To just say, no, I don't know how to do a podcast company. I don't know how to interview people. You know, all the things that are the no's in front of you, push them aside and know that you can learn anything you need to know how to do, except maybe brain surgery. I mean, I wouldn't want you to learn by doing there, but we can learn by doing.
Yeah.
And that's the risk taking that is necessary if we're going to move forward.
That risk taking. So I love this idea where we're going, because I feel like so many podcasters, when they step into, hey, and that I'm gonna produce a podcast and I'm gonna put it out there in the world, and maybe it'll be something that can make me money someday, or maybe it'll change somebody's life if they hear it, or maybe I'll actually make an impact by sharing my story. And then they tell somebody in their family or their friends, and they're like, a podcast? What's a podcast? Is that really like the smartest thing for you to do? And then that can make somebody doubt themselves and mm-hmm. and think, oh wait, maybe this isn't a smart risk right. for me. And I do believe that every podcast should have some, you know, strategy like behind it to understand, like that's paired with your why are you doing it this and what is your strategy for it. However, I also believe that everyone can podcast. It's just figuring out the why and what the strategy is. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on someone who's starting to maybe doubt whether or not doing something with purpose or doing something to hopefully make an impact in someone else's life? Like, is that a valuable use of someone's time?
I can't think of anything more useful than pursuing with passion something you feel so strongly about, you want to sit down and do it every day or every opportunity you get. And to pursue that kind of passionate interest or commitment, and then to do that with a purpose, which is the way I've always thought about podcasts. You know, podcasts are at their best, great conversations. They just, you want to drop in, you want to eavesdrop. And you want to hear every word. And that's what makes podcasts special. They are also often informative. And some podcasts you go to directly for real, concrete, specific information. I've done that a lot during this pandemic to get from experts. But then there's some podcasts I go to just because it's a great story. I know I'm going to hear interesting stories. And there's nothing more compelling, day in and day out than good storytelling. So podcasts take, for me, the best of the format of storytelling, because they allow for relaxed, intimate conversation, one to one, and to be able to hear someone's thoughts and ideas and reflections in that kind of intimate environment, but to do it with sometimes more than the purpose of just sharing a story, although that's a good enough purpose as far as I'm concerned, but to do it with the purpose of sharing information or guiding someone somewhere, or, you know, in their own life's journey. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do. I always loved radio, Christine, and I worked in radio in my early days in media. And even though I had this big television job, people would say to me, why are you going over there to that dinky little radio station and doing drive time radio when you have this big television job? And I was like, yeah, but I love that radio environment because I felt more intimate. It felt more like I was being listened to. You are being listened to. And what a great thing that is, to be able to communicate information and storytelling in that way. So,
what has been one of your favorite podcasts to listen to in the pandemic?
Oh dear, I knew you were going to ask me that, and I never remember the names of podcasts. I mean, I listen to The Daily like everybody else in the world, or many people in the world, because I find that he always takes a subject and dives very deep into it in ways that I enjoy. And I've listened to, what is it called? See, I can't think of any of the names of them now that you've asked me, especially not with today with my scrambled mind. But and then there's a podcast out of London with a scientist that my husband and I both admire a lot. And so we listen to him on a regular basis. I keep NPR on in my car and in my bathroom constantly when I'm doing things around the house. So that's whatever podcaster. I subscribe to all of them. So,
something that you mention in your book, and it's when you're interviewing Christian Amanpour, and I know you recently interviewed her again for your new show.
Yes, I did.
A digital show.
Yeah, she was the first one to do the FinTech series with me.
Yes. Something you guys talk about is journalists getting too involved. And if that's really a thing, how it's the difference between daring enough to be truthful rather than neutral. And and the quote goes on to say, our profession's golden rule of objectivity does not mean drawing a false moral equivalence between aggressor and victim.
Yeah. Yeah, Christine.
I'd love to dive into that.
Yeah. Well, it's a very... it's a very important point, actually, about journalists, and in particular today, when there doesn't seem to be anything that's close to objectivity, because journalism has become, like everything else, sort of politicized in ways that are toxic and negative. Our journalists have become advocates for points of view. But I think what Christiane is referring to there is when she reported on the Bosnian War with such passion, and as she revealed to the world for the first time the atrocities of that war, she wasn't being objective. She was saying, this is horrific, what is happening here. And she did it with a kind of passion that some people interpreted, I think, as advocacy for one side or the other, and criticized her for not being objective. I'm just remembering this was part of what she talked to me about then, because we were working together at that time. So, but I don't think she's saying that it's okay for journalists to be partisan. That's not the same as being engaged and passionate and truthful. And truth is the big word here. What she's saying is, if telling the truth is what's important, not not the importance of being or seeming to be objective about the truth. Truth isn't subjective, you know. We forgot that during the 4 years of our last president. Truth actually is an absolute.
Yes.
So I don't want to speak for Christiane and how she might be thinking about that, because she says it so beautifully there. But I do remember the early days of her reporting from the front lines of war, and I ran into it constantly in my reporting. I was always told, oh, you're playing the women's card. You're always speaking up and advocating for women. And yes, I was, because often their points of view were not being presented without some sort of fervent advocacy. But there was truth too in what I wanted to report about them.
Yeah. I think that's such an important point, and it is so like murky, it's such a murky area
it's hard to
talk about. I find myself having conversations with people about like journalism and objectivity and what happens if a journalist gets too close to a story so much that they have a feeling about it, because I would also argue, aren't we human? Like humanity is such a huge part of storytelling and of journalism. So maybe it's more truthful to be truthful about how you're feeling about what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Whether like, so being honest about your feelings while also sharing the truth of the story. It's like this weird balance that I think that but we're uncovering. We're in a really weird time, I think, for journalists. And I would actually argue that a lot of local journalists try really hard to be as objective as possible with their storytelling, where it becomes way more political the higher up you go and you do make that, that national stage.
Yeah, it is a difficult time for journalism because, as I said, we've lost respect for the truth. Mm-hmm. Truth has become out of the mouths of which partisan is saying it. All you have to do is look at the fact that 70% of the Republicans in this country right now don't believe we have a legitimate president, who still believe the election was unfair. There's just facts about that. And facts are a kind of truth. And for journalists who are trying to cover things, they do. There's a difference too between being objective and giving all sides of a story. Mm-hmm. And it isn't two sides. There are all kinds of sides to a story. So it is a journalist's responsibility, in my opinion, to give as much of the full 360-degree view on any subject or issue or situation.
Yeah.
But to do it without emotion, and maybe this is what Christiane was getting at, that's first of all not possible, because we all do have emotional responses to things, and rightly so. So it is a very thin line, and it again goes back to that word balance, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And we have been out of balance on that side, particularly in the news media, which has become so partisan and so political that it is hard to find fact and truth and all of that. So I think it's an issue worthy of several other podcasts.
Yeah. speaking of, politics, you worked in Washington, D.C., and you've got a chapter in your book, Playing the Power Game. And I feel like I learned from listening to the different power dynamics that you experienced showing up in these rooms that, where people may have wanted something from you, and it's really easy to like want to be like, oh, I'm here because I'm so amazing and people love me and I'm on a TV show. Like, at least I've felt that way before, being a TV news reporter in Los Angeles, and all of a sudden people treat you like more special and you think, oh, wow, maybe like there is something more special about me. But wait, why was I really invited to this party?
Right.
And I love how you ask those questions of yourself. Like, so important.
in Washington, Christine, you have to really ask yourself that question constantly about power, because everything in that city is so motivated by what power someone has, and whether it's real or perceived, and half the time it isn't real. But there is real power there too. You know, elected people have real power, and the press has real power. So hosting a show that was also a news and information program, yeah, I had a sphere of influence. Did I have power to make things change or happen? I did struggle with that concept, because it is a town where everything is focused on power. So is Los Angeles, as I mentioned in the book too, because I moved from DC to LA and I found the similarities astonishing. It just, it's a different power base. But both towns are one industry towns, Washington politics, LA film and entertainment business. But they're based on how close you are. Your power is based on how close you are to the people who have real power. And you can get caught up in that, and people do. And it's destructive, and it's deceptive too, because it can make you feel that you have a kind of influence you don't have, but it can also make you feel that you're not, or lead you to diminish the influence that you actually do have. So power is like everything else we're talking about, a tricky balance, but it's so important to recognize that we all have it, that every person in every room has a certain degree of it, and that how we use it is what matters. It isn't how much we have or how close we are to the source of power in that room or in that city or town. It's what are we doing with the influence that we do have?
Yeah. More looking within instead of who we're standing next to.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. That's, yeah, that is powerful. I think once you even just start thinking about that.
Right. And time is powerful in our lives, and I'm running out of it. I'm so sorry that I am going to have to close this in just a few minutes. And it's so hard to do, because I'm really enjoying a very thought-provoking conversation, which is the very best thing that podcasts can do too. When I listen to one, I always say, am I still thinking an hour or so later or maybe the next day? And I often am. And sometimes, as you've noticed, I can't even tell you what particular podcast it was, but it was something I heard. And there is still for me something about hearing it as opposed to the visual thing of seeing and hearing, which I also, of course, want in my life. But I am a big believer in these kind of intimate conversations, whether they're only on audio or whether you have the opportunity to have both. But we need more of this. We need more of this now, probably more than ever, because we're all navigating through the end of this unprecedented time to what's next. And what's next, by the way, is the theme for this year's TED Women. So I should just mention that we thought, what can we do at TED Women that will kind of give us a platform for looking at what's next in our lives? What's next in technology? What's next in podcast and television and film and writing and politics and science discovery? So I'll have to come back and talk about that another time.
Podcasters out there for sure would love to be a speaker at TED Women, at TEDx, at any TED event. If there's a podcaster listening who's like, how do I do that, Pat? Do you have advice for them?
Well, there is a place on the TED.com website where you can self-nominate yourself, and those names do go in to the pool of considerations. The TED conferences have several different sets of curators. So depending on where the idea sort of fits, that group of curators will look at it. And then there, you know, for TED Women, we specifically focus on women, as you know. And I'm happy to review or at least send to, I don't do this by myself. There are 10 curators. But the best thing is to either self-nominate or get someone to go on TED.com and nominate you. Say, this is my favorite podcaster, or I think I want to hear more from this host or person.
Yeah, that's a great
idea. An amazing number of people end up on the stage who have self-nominated or been nominated, because it's really about the uniqueness of the idea. Before you nominate yourself or have someone nominate you, just think this: what will be the takeaway of my 10 minutes or 12 minutes on stage? What will my TED talk really be about? And that's because that's what the TED team will ask. What will the audience be left with? What will they walk away from this TED talk thinking, believing, feeling, thinking about? It's the impact of the talk.
Absolutely. Pat, thank you for making such an impact on this podcast, on me. Thank you for being a part of this show, and I wish you luck with whatever you have next today. I know you've got a lot of big stuff happening, so thank you again for being on my show.
Well, thank you for understanding, and since I think I have a couple of minutes I didn't use, we'll just add them on to the next one, I hope.
For sure, we will.
Okay. Thank you, Christine. So
and that's a wrap. Thank you for listening to another episode of Podcast Coaching with Christine. For more information on this week's episode, be sure to check the show notes. You can also find more information on my website, christine-o'donnell.com. There's a bunch of resources over there as well, and more information about my community if you would like to join it. Again, that's christine-o'donnell.com. If this podcast helped you in any way, please let me know. You can always screenshot that you've listened to this episode and then share it in your stories and tag me on Instagram. I am happy to reshare your story and let more people know about what you're doing, your podcast. Thank you again for listening, and I will see you next time.